dried cotton in the ditch. We all picked the cotton, but we never got rich. Daddy was a veteran, a Southern Democrat. They ought to get a rich man to vote like that. Sing it. Song, song of the South. Sweet potato pie and I shut my mouth. Gone, gone with the wind. There ain't nobody looking back again.
Welcome back to the Jeff Horst Show at Talk 106.5. Thank you very much for listening on this Friday morning. We do appreciate it. 251-340-1006. You want to respond to anything we are talking about, hit us up on that text line. That's your best bet. We'll try to give you a prompt response. You may not like it, but everybody except for you, Ricky, and Crystal Decay. So make sure you stay tuned and utilize the text line. Joining us on the line now, though, as we do about this time every Friday when we are on the air, our returning champion, State Senator Chris Elliott, joins us. Good morning, Senator. How are you?
Good morning. I am doing great. Back in Baldwin County as of this morning, and glad to be back.
Hey, it's good to hear your voice, man. We went a whole 2 weeks apart, so it's good to reunite. Let's kick it off here. ARPA funds still outstanding. That's COVID relief money for those of you out there. Talk a little bit about that, getting the legislature together. Is this something that is obviously going to kind of be decided upon in January?
It is, and likely probably the first tranche of it here in the upcoming session in January. The second tranche of it will come in June, and then I wouldn't be surprised if we ended up with a special session sometime in the late summer, mid to late summer, to appropriate the second tranche of money. This is one of those things that I have mixed feelings about, seeing what this flood of federal dollars is doing to our economy overall, but it's coming. And the question is, when it's given to you, how do you make the best use of it, and how, what's the most impactful way to do it? But Jeff, just to clue everybody in on how much we're talking about just shy of $4 billion. $2 billion to the state. The counties are getting $1 billion. Metro cities are getting just over $400 million, and then the rest of the small cities are getting about $400 million, too, that's divided up. But the state legislature will end up divvying up $2 billion in the upcoming year, and that is an entire general fund budget again.
Well, you keep having these windfalls. It's like you say, though, the federal government's stolen out. We got to make responsible use of it. What is the is there a back and forth? Is there a consensus? What does that look like? Somebody offering up proposals.
Well, that's the other thing that needs to be talked about too. Is when you look at the ARPA money, this leaves out all of the air quote transportation money, the infrastructure bill that was passed, where you've got a whole nother bunch of money coming in from that. So there's some overlap in the two of those. And this is what the legislature is going to have to really wrap their head around. If we're spending it on, you know, water quality improvement as it relates to sewers, which is a big deal in our area, obviously, I think that's one thing. Broadband as well, but we need to make sure we do that right so that we're not paying private companies to do something they were going to do anyway. And so we make sure that if we're going to use state dollars to do that, public dollars to do that, that these folks are actually connecting with speeds that are actually useful to the end user. So you'll see a lot of that. What money can we use on infrastructure? Not a lot of the ARPA money, but the transportation money. And then there's some other capital investment money out there. It's going to be really putting it all on the table and putting the right pieces in the right place to make sure that while I would not have voted for this legislation and I wish it hadn't passed in Washington, it's here, and we need to make sure we use it the best way we can, as impactful as we can, and in a nature that is one time, so that we don't create any traps for us later on where we have to continue to funding things we wouldn't have otherwise funded.
Right. You don't want to use it for pay raises or any new programs. You got to, and that really narrows your choices. I mean, it just seems counterintuitive, but when you're at that level, especially at state government, it's hard to spend these big pots of money, right?
It is, and you know, I'm a small business guy, and my inclination is to cut costs, right? How do we make this thing more efficiently, run more efficiently? And now our issue before us is somebody is giving us, the feds, if you will, this windfall of cash. How do we use it the best way? and in a way that we don't get addicted to it. And that is the real challenge. This is almost harder than lean budget times, you know, to budget in times where things are flush.
Yeah, because, well, everybody's wanting a piece of the pie. And, you know, the thing is, only so much of that could be put towards something. Can you move this money around? Can you move it to where, to say, the general fund is paying for this expenditure, but under ARPA, under this act, you can't spend it for that, but we'll move that money here, and then we'll move this money here for something else and play some games? Or is it not that simple?
Well, I would say that the game is not that simple, but the concept is, and I think that's exactly what we need to look at doing. Of course, the federal money comes with a ton of strings attached to it, and figuring out what are those strings, how we can you know, be smart and use them effectively. But here's the real challenge. Every other state is going to be getting the same thing or more. They're going to be competitively, if you look at it that way, at the same advantage we are. They're going to be improving their infrastructure. They're going to be improving their water quality. They're going to be improving their broadband connectivity and things of that nature. So we've got to think very carefully about how we use this and make sure we use this as effectively as possible to increase our competitiveness in the economy.
I mean, it's like when they're zigging, we need to zag. So if they're all upgrading their water infrastructure, if they're all upgrading their, whatever it may be, rural broadband, that all of a sudden you're going to have a demand for products associated with those two concepts. And this is just what happens. The economic laws and theories apply here, that when those things are demand, the cost is going to go up for those, and it's going to make it more expensive for the state to do this business if everybody's trying to spend money on the same thing, right?
You're exactly right. And that's something we're seeing time and time again, is the cost of goods going up because the government is spending more money, not just our individuals, because we're doing that too, and we're driving the cost of things up, but the government is spending so much more money. Again, here's $4 billion being injected into this side of the government. That's not including the $3 billion that went to the Department of Education, but you get the idea. It's billions and billions of dollars in the state doing things that makes the cost go up. It changes the market. And unfortunately, there are a lot of bad side effects of that, including making the cost of goods and services to the government increase as well. And that is just that's a nasty cycle. And unfortunately, I think it's one we're just going to have to hold on and endure.
Well, and making the right choices, like I said, it presents some hurdles for sure. What is the you get any guidance from the governor?
Well, you know, we heard this week, and it was in a meeting where former Representative Bill Poole, now the finance director, was presenting and talking about a lot of these challenges. And I will tell you, she's made a great choice in having Bill Poole as the finance director. He understands the state's finances. He understands the legislature and is just a whiz when it comes to that. So I think we're in as good a shape from the governor's standpoint as we've ever been with this administration, now that she's got Bill Poole in there to help guide and help educate the legislature on some of the more administrative tasks associated with dispersing these funds.
Joined by State Senator Chris Elliott here on the program. Senator, tell me, Joe Bonner, now the officially, I guess, the president of the University of South Alabama, what do you think that's going? Is anything going to change? Liz Fillmore now filling the role of chief of staff, but it was always thought of that at least Joe Bonner had this institutional wisdom dealing with the Alabama legislature. I'm sure you are well aware of that, having had many discussions with the former congressman. But what do you think going forward is going to look like with some changes in the Ivy administration?
It's going to be different, and I'm not sure I know how to answer that question. I think that's going to have to be a wait and see. Of course, I've known Joe Bonner for a long time. We've had an interesting relationship, but have known him for a long time, and I knew what I was getting, and he knew what he was getting. I don't have that relationship with what's really kind of left of the governor's staff at this point, and it'll be curious to see how they operate. Does it change at all? Are they more engaged with the legislature or less? And then, frankly, what do you see as re-election comes around and change in cabinet officials, too? It's not unusual to see cabinet officials change after the end of 4 years, but we've got cabinet officials that have been there since the beginning of the Bentley administration. So the question will be, do any of those officials change? And how does that affect South Alabama, and how does that affect the relationship with the legislature?
Senator, while Sean Sullivan and I were away on Monday, your colleague, Greg Albritton, was on with Rusty Glover. Rusty asked him this question, like, Senator, do you think there's a possibility? And he actually named her out to me, saying that it's not a possibility, and I'm sticking to my guns here, but do you think it's a possibility that we could see gaming come back on, come up in this fourth year of a quadrennium while everyone's trying to get reelected or whatever, that it could be part of this session that begins in January? And Senator Auburn said, absolutely, yes, we don't just quit working in the fourth year of a quadrennium because it's election season, that he intends to see gaming revisited in 2022. What do you think of that?
You know, you asked me that question a couple of weeks ago, and I think my answer was I thought the chances of that were about as good as me winning the lottery. And I will tell you, I was wrong. I think that after the last couple of weeks and conversations I've had, that you will see a piece of legislation that is substantially similar to what passed the Senate come up again. Whether or not the same votes are there or not is really a question. But I think that the likelihood that something passes out of the Senate, a comprehensive bill again, is likely. The question is, have any minds or attitudes changed in the House? And is there an appetite for that? And quite frankly, what does Governor Ivey do? Does she wade back into it like she did last time? Does she stay completely away from it? That's where the politics and the campaigning come to play, especially when you have somebody like Tim James, who's a vocal anti-gaming person, getting in the race. Does she decide to get into this or not? And that'll be the thing to watch.
Well, I tell you, we had Steve Lewison on earlier this week, too, and he said the same thing you said, that the bill will probably look a lot like what we saw passed out of the legislature earlier this year, or out of the Senate, I should say. But the way the House responded to it, and I think this Nathaniel Ledbetter, the majority leader, who's making some serious gestures toward being Speaker, said that the bill the Senate sent downstairs was unworkable. It was DOA in the House. This is one of these situations where do you have any confidence that the House of Representatives is interested in this?
Well, I'm not an expert on the House by any stretch of the imagination, but I will say this: I've heard that from the House before on things like vaccine mandates, and then they went ahead and passed it. So I guess at the end of the day, we'll just have to wait and see. Sometimes this is a matter of kind of taking your time, seeing what actually gets out of the Senate, if it is substantially similar. But I will say this, too. I don't know why you would start with something brand new and undo the work that's already been done, the votes that have already been counted upstairs, and start over. So the likelihood that something gets downstairs and that the House has to contend with it is probably better than even.
Says if you were reading my mind on the vaccine mandate, because that's where we're going to take it next. SB9 making it out of the Senate into law. Governor signs it. No help from the governor, but you got it done, and you overcome all the odds. It looks to me, anecdotally, that there are a lot of these big businesses, be it whatever, big institutions. They're just flouting the spirit of the law, that they are proceeding as they have always had, and not really taking time to observe the facets of what is state statute now, and proceeding ahead by denying exemptions and making it very, very cumbersome to even to apply for an exemption. That Is that something you're seeing or hearing about?
I've had some initial frustrations with some of the things I've seen out there about the the nature of the forms that are that were out while the Department of Labor was kind of promulgating its own form and putting into a rule, if you will, what the statute said. But the statute prescribes a specific form. Now, can employers ask additional questions? Yeah, maybe. Do employees have to answer them? No, not necessarily. State law doesn't require that, and I think they'd have a leg to stand on if they simply didn't answer those additional questions. But what I'm seeing is that if folks are applying for a religious exemption or a medical exemption, by and large, they're getting it. And if they're not, they need to go to the Department of Labor's website. They need to make their employer look at what's there as far as the form and the guidance from the Department of Labor. Jeff, I talked to the Department of Labor yesterday. There have been over 32,000 hits in a week on that website, downloading that form, filling those forms out, the exemption forms. And I am thrilled that it seems, from what I can tell, most folks are getting these exemptions when they apply for them. The vast majority of them are. And Department of Labor, as of yesterday, told me only 19 appeals had been submitted so far. Now, that's a week, but only 19 appeals so far. So if your employer, since the signing of this bill about 3 weeks ago, has terminated you because of your vaccine status, you've got a right to appeal, and you absolutely should, and there's a form and an easy way to do that.
Senator, we've got to leave it there. You've been very kind to make time for us this morning, and let's talk again soon.
Sounds great. Thanks for having me on. Enjoy your weekend.
You do the same. Stay, Senator Chris Elliott, our returning champion there. We got to get one more break in here. We'll be right back. This is the Jeff Poore Show on FM Talk 106.5.
Just to send it on down.